A border wall on private land paid for with private money. Any problems? You betcha. A demand to stop construction in South Texas. That story and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. As Democratic candidates take the stage again tonight for another debate, no Texans will join them. What happened to the Beto effect, and why isn't John Cornyn worried? Also, the men and women who serve in uniform who don't get counted as veterans, lawmakers taking a closer look at why not. Plus, duck and cover, a battle in Pearland over web-footed residents. What'll they do? All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started. Right after this. No matter where you are, you're on Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this 20th day of November 2019. Hope you're having a great Wednesday. As you may have heard, Texas is getting another visit from the Commander-in-Chief, the second in as many months. This time, the focus is on an Apple manufacturing facility in the state capital city. The presidential visit is supposed to highlight companies that are making things in the U.S., but since Texas is seen as critical to a Trump victory in 2020, no doubt this is about politics, pure and simple, too. More later in the Texas Roundup. First things first, a nonprofit group that's been raising money for a border wall and clearing ground for it on private land in South Texas. They've been ordered to stop. Sandra Sanchez has been tracking this story for BorderReport.com. Ms. Sanchez, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Set the scene for us here. Where exactly is this land that has been cleared for a wall? What part of the Rio Grande Valley are we talking about here?
We're talking about south of Mission, Texas, which is in western Hidalgo County. Hidalgo is the county where McAllen, the largest city in the lower Rio Grande Valley, is located. This is a private land that's about 3.5 miles long, or 6,000 acres of riverfront property, owned by a gentleman whose grandfather actually founded a local bank. I spoke with him, Mr. Lance Newhouse, and he did confirm that we build the wall. We're on his property with his permission last week.
Okay, so a Hidalgo County judge has now told this nonprofit group to stop clearing land. Is this a formal court order, or is this through some kind of cease and desist request, or what?
Actually, Hidalgo County Judge Richard Cortez told me Border Patrol told him that they have told We Build the Wall that they have to stop what they're doing. So when I spoke with the International Boundary and Water Commission Secretary for the U.S. Section, Sally Spiner, she told me late last week they actually sent a letter to We Build the Wall telling them that they had to stop construction until they have a chance to review their project and their plans to see if it complies with the international water treaties.
I see. So this is not, technically speaking, a court order to stop. This is a cease and desist letter is what it sounds like.
Yes.
But they are telling this group to stop doing what they're doing on perfectly private land, right?
They are saying it's on private land. The reason is it's in a floodplain. The Rio Grande is very wide at this point. It's very deep, and it's prone to flooding in the area. Environmentalists and neighbors like the National Butterfly Center, which is located very close to this property, are worried that this is going to cause flooding in the river, debris to flow down the river, obstructions to the river.
Let's go back for just a moment and talk a little bit about the construction that has been done up to this point. How much has actually been put into the ground, and how big of a wall are they talking about putting up?
We rode the river on Thursday afternoon with a Catholic priest, Father Roy Snipes, and at that point they had cleared probably about 2 mile swath. It had rained very heavily earlier in the week, and there was a lot of mud, and we peered in through the Carrizo Cane, and you could just see large sections where it had just been bulldozed. We have seen no wall panels actually being put up. We do not know how tall these wall panels are. Typically, We Build the Wall does not build to spec as the federal government does. Mm-hmm. An example being what they built in Sunland Park, New Mexico, earlier this year.
So what about this group, We Build the Wall? What are they saying about whether or not they intend to comply with the cease and desist letter?
We have not heard from them. They are a 501c4. They're a nonprofit advocacy organization. They do a lot of their communication via social media. And over the weekend, they continued to post videos saying, you know, we're here, we're still building, we're still digging.
If this group decides that it's going to ignore the letter, what would be the next step?
Right. The International Boundary and Water Commission is tasked with overseeing the 1944 U.S. Mexico Water Treaty, as well as the 1970 provision that explains how any construction can be built on the river to maintain its integrity and to prevent flooding or obstruction of floodwaters. So, you know, the ball looks like it falls to IBWC. I have FOIA'd a request to them for the letter, and I've asked them what they would do if the organization doesn't comply. And they said, well, we've told them to stop construction until we can review their plans, but they have not submitted their plans. So
IBWC, just to be clear on the what that stands for.
International Boundary and Water Commission. And there's two sections to the IBWC. The U.S. section is based in El Paso. Mm-hmm. And then there's a Mexican section as well. And they get together and they meet and they agree upon how the water will be shared between the two countries and utilized.
Sandra Sanchez is a South Texas correspondent for BorderReport.com. They cover the border 24/7 as a digital initiative affiliated with the NextStar stations. Sandra, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Another Democratic presidential debate tonight. The lineup on stage will look almost identical to October's, minus a couple of Texans. Julian Castro didn't make the cut because of his poll numbers. Beto O'Rourke pulled out of the running altogether. But O'Rourke's name continues to hang over another important race in 2020, the one for U.S. Senator from Texas. 11 Democratic candidates are running to unseat longtime Republican incumbent John Cornyn. But there are questions about whether any of Cornyn's current challengers have what it takes to measure up to O'Rourke's breakout bid against Ted Cruz in 2018. Jeremy Wallace has been writing about that. He covers Texas politics for the Houston Chronicle. Jeremy, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Oh, great to be with you.
So you write that O'Rourke is casting a shadow on these 11 candidates. How so? Just because he did so well against Ted Cruz?
Well, that is absolutely true. But additionally, just the pace he set as a candidate for the U.S. Senate is hard for any of these candidates to match. And when you think of a year before 2018, you know, he had logged 120 different, you know, rallies and, you know, meetings throughout the state and been to half the counties already at this point. And so he had just a pace that I think, you know, none of the current field is quite trying to keep up, just because they have a different kind of race, and they're just not Beto O'Rourke.
Well, let's talk about someone like MJ Haggar, who got a lot of attention with certainly online for some of her campaign ads when she tried to unseat Central Texas Congressman John Carter in the midterm, and she came awfully close to doing that. Was that more about her, or was that some kind of Beto effect going on there?
Well, certainly she has get a lot of credit for that. It's not so easy to raise the kind of money she was able to raise for what many people thought was an uphill race. In that respect, you know, she, like a lot of the other candidates, have like little hints of Beto, right? You know, it's like Beto was one of those candidates, like it didn't make sense how he was able to raise so much money in a race that outside of Texas, for sure, people thought was a lost cause. And Haggar, like, really showed that she could do that too. And I think that ability to raise money and that ability to compete really kind of, you know, shows that she made that race competitive.
Well, let's do some Monday morning quarterbacking here, because Beto O'Rourke has said he's pretty, you know, he's pretty adamant. He's not going to run for Senate. He's not going to try to unseat John Cornyn himself. Well, so did he blow it in the first place trying to jump from unsuccessful U.S. Senate candidate to a challenger in a U.S. presidential contest? Should he have taken that next move and tried to take on Cornyn in the first place?
Well, there's a hearty debate, right? That's what a lot of Texans have been talking about. You know, we got to put ourselves in where we were in January and February. I think Beto O'Rourke, when he was coming out of the U.S. Senate race, he had said he wasn't going to run for president, right? You know, he was pretty convincing that he wasn't going to.
Yeah.
But then he met with President Barack Obama. And after that, things changed. Who knows what that conversation really, happened, what happened in that conversation. But certainly, that's where O'Rourke changed things. And I think he got swept up in the energy of it, like a lot of, would-be presidential candidates would be. But, there's a lot of people who would tell you that just because O'Rourke did well against Ted Cruz, it didn't mean he matched up well against John Cornyn. Cornyn occupies more of a moderate lane in Republican politics than Ted Cruz does. And where O'Rourke succeeded was he was able to pull independents and moderates away from Ted Cruz.
I just a couple of seconds left, but why do you think he didn't do his campaign for president seemed to be so dismal?
Yeah, and it's one of those things where once Joe Biden got in the race, it changed the race. When O'Rourke got in the race, there was still a 50-50 question about whether Biden really wanted to do this or not.
Yeah.
And so what Beto O'Rourke was offering himself as was Pete Buttigieg and a lot of other candidates, on the more moderate wing at that point, was like, if Biden's not running, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are the two leading candidates. Do you want an alternative? I'm that guy. But once Biden got in the race, it just changed the calculus. If you watch, when Biden got in the race in late April, Beto O'Rourke's poll numbers dropped from 10% to 1% or 2%, like just in a couple of months. And you saw towards the end, O'Rourke was trying to find a way to energize a more liberal group within the Democratic Party. And it didn't look like it felt right. And you could see, that's where he really started to lose support and couldn't make it to the debate stage.
I guess one of the takeaways here is that it's not always just about the candidates. It's about the mix. And Jeremy Wallace has been covering that for the Houston Chronicle, where he covers Texas politics. Jeremy, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me on, David.
What's happening out there? Let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Social media keeping a watchful eye on impeachment inquiry testimony. Mm-hmm. In the hot seat today, President Donald Trump's personally selected Ukraine advisor Gordon Sondland testifying that pressure on Ukraine to announce an investigation into the Biden family was widely known throughout the White House. Everyone was in the loop, he said. It was no secret. That includes Energy Secretary and former Texas Governor Rick Perry, Sondland testified. On our Facebook page, Leah Keese says, watching this, he is pretty well throwing them all under the bus. Considering the potential repercussions, Leah adds, Sondland has no reason to lie. Jeremy Rushing says, now we know why Perry got out of the White House so quickly, referring to his stepping down from that post to step down from that post. And Kenneth Shilkin asks, when will Rudy Giuliani testify, the figure at so much of this Ukraine intrigue? Speaking of President Trump, he's still scheduled for a quick trip through Texas today, visiting an Apple computers factory in Austin.
Yeah.
Should make for some interesting small talk with him and Tim Cook,
Indeed, yeah, we think so. Hey, what's making news in your part of Texas? Reach out to us, won't you, at Texas Standard. Wells will be back in 35. Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Not everyone who served in uniform is considered a veteran, including some people who spent years in the National Guard. Members of the Guard who respond to domestic missions, like providing disaster relief or working along the southern U.S. border, may not qualify for VA benefits. It's an issue that Congress is now taking a second look, as Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project.
In April 2018, President Trump ordered 2,000 National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexico border to aid Homeland Security. During a tour in October 2018, Border Patrol spokesman William Rogers complimented the California National Guard, who were working inside a Border Patrol station in San Diego, acting as dispatchers and monitoring cameras.
What's most important about it to us is the fact that prior to the National Guard soldiers filling these spots, we had to have sworn agents filling these spots.
Despite the kind words, some of these Guard troops working along the border in uniform may never meet the federal definition of a veteran. One of the things Guard troops need to qualify for VA benefits, like health care or the GI Bill, is to serve 180 days continuously on active duty. That means being requested by the federal government under specific circumstances, says Daniel Elkins, a special forces operator with a guard unit in L.A. I reached him via Skype in Utah, where he's training to deploy overseas.
This affects many members of the National Guard. For example, currently, there's a federally declared border crisis that's going on.
Even though the president asked for the Guard and the federal government paid for the operation, their orders don't count toward being considered a veteran under federal law. Elkins also works with the Enlisted Association of National Guard United States, which is lobbying to bring greater parity between active duty and the Guard and Reserve troops, like making it easier for them to qualify to become veterans by letting them add up all the times they spend on federal orders instead of just serving 180 consecutive days.
Those should be added up, and when you meet that threshold, you should be considered a veteran and rate the same level of benefits and service as an active duty counterpart.
Most of the time, Guard troops are under the control of the governor, who can call them up to help with natural disasters like the wildfires in California. But there are a variety of missions. Congressman Mike Levin, whose district covers parts of San Diego County, chairs a veteran subcommittee which recently held hearings on these parity issues.
We haven't followed a very basic principle, which is if you are expected to be doing the same sort of thing, putting your life on the line for whatever particular mission, I believe you ought to be able to get the same pay and benefits.
Levin says Congress has been slow to respond to the changing role of the Guard, which has been used more consistently since September 11, 2001.
The expectations and the demands placed on our National Guard and Reserves that perhaps weren't there previously, we have to make sure that federal policy reflects that.
Elkins, the Guard Special Forces operator preparing for deployment, says he's talked with former Guard troops who applied for benefits under the GI Bill after reporting to disasters like Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf Coast or Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico.
And these members, they serve, they deploy, they're being told that they're being deployed, and they assume that they have the same level of benefits.
But they don't. He says that impacts retention in the Guard, but the consequences can run much deeper. Those federal benefits include long-term mental health care at the VA. The VA estimates 919 suicides in 2017 among Guard and Reserve members who never achieved veteran status, all former military, but not considered veterans. In San Diego, I'm Steve Walsh.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration reporting on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Cities send out a lot of press releases, not all of which surface on the front page. An exception was this alert sent out last week by the city of Pearland, a suburb of Houston. The title, Muscovy Duck Migration, What Pearland Residents Should Know. Part of the second paragraph reads, the city of Pearland received numerous inquiries as to the removal of Muscovy ducks. Unfortunately, it was discovered that some planned on doing so illegally. Wait a minute, illegal duck removal, you say? What exactly is going on in Pearland? Well, the Houston Chronicle recently dispatched reporter Emily Foxhall to find out, and she joins us now here on the Texas Standard. Emily, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First, describe these ducks for us. What is a Muscovy duck? Where do they come from? How many are there? And what do they look like? All that sort of thing.
Well, the Muscovy duck is native to Central America, so it's not native to most of Texas. They're considered an invasive species under federal law.
All right.
The people who don't like the ducks will tell you they're really ugly. They have these kind of warty red faces, and their feathers are mostly white, and they look black, but when you get a little closer, they're kind of this dark emerald color also.
So ugly ducklings. So. All right. and what sort of problems do these ducks cause?
The people who don't like the ducks will tell you that there's lots of duck poop on the street and on the sidewalk. And if you walk around some of these neighborhoods, you can see that for yourself. And they just kind of get in the way. Like if you're trying to drive down the street, they might just stare at you in your car. Or if you're trying to pull out of the driveway, they might not get out of the way very fast.
Yes. All right. Now, I understand there is a divide in the neighborhood between those who are okay with the ducks being there and those who aren't. How does that manifest itself?
Yeah, I'd go as far as to say there are people who like very much love these ducks. They some people put out a kiddie pool for them to swim in, and there's a number of neighbors who have been feeding them sometimes for years every day.
Oh, wow.
So that really makes their neighbors who dislike the ducks angry because they wish these ducks would just go away, and they think the people who are feeding them are only adding to the problem. There were a number of people who told us that coming across dead ducks on the side of the road is not an uncommon occurrence. And there were several stories told to us about little kids who are seeing these ducks kind of dead by the sidewalk and crying or asking their parents why this is happening. So there's some people who have gone rogue, and at least one person in the city thinks has been shooting them with bows and arrows. And some people say that they've seen them run over by cars there.
Oh, man.
But that's not what you're supposed to be doing. The city said, if you want to get rid of these ducks, you have the right to catch them on your own property.
But then what do you do with them? I mean, do you take them to the next nearby town? What do you do with these ducks?
Yeah, the city hasn't been clear about that. You can dispose of them, they say, so long as you're following laws about animal cruelty and laws about weapons. But I think that's why this caused such a stir, is they weren't totally clear about, you know, how it is you can get rid of these ducks legally.
Let me ask you something. Is it possible that someone brought these ducks, you know, to float around peacefully in some nearby pond as ornamentation? Is that how this got started, or is anyone clear what happened?
Yeah, I don't know quite how the ducks got there, but they have gotten to other places. And I think, you know, this whole thing was interesting to me because there are some people who live there who are like, how in the world did this become such a big issue? You know, they think that there is a way for the people of Pearland and the ducks of Pearland to live peacefully together.
Mm-hmm.
And they're mad that everybody is arguing about it and that it's gotten to this point where people are perhaps killing the ducks in the middle of the night. So I think there's people who would say, just get over it and learn to live with these animals that some people find cute. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if they're able to strike some sort of compromise or what solution they land on.
Emily Foxhall is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She's been covering what the quack is going on in Pearland. We'll have a link to her story about the Pearland duck disaster at texasstandard.org. Emily, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. More than 100 groups are launching a statewide initiative today to ensure Texans are accurately counted in the 2020 census. It's called Texas Counts. Ann Beeson is CEO of the Center for Public Policy Priorities, one of the organizations behind the effort. She explains they're taking action in lieu of a state-funded effort to ensure participation in the national headcount.
And that is one of the reasons that we felt that we had to step in and create an effort to help support for all the communities around the state who know how essential a complete census count is to Texas continuing to thrive in the future and how essential it is for our democracy.
Beeson says a 1% undercount could result in a $300 million annual loss in federal funding for Texas. Air Force One is en route to Austin, where President Trump will tour an Apple computer plant with the company's CEO, Tim Cook, this afternoon. The U.S. Treasury Secretary and National Economic Council Director are scheduled to join the visit. Apple recently announced plans to expand production in the Texas capital after securing federal tariff exemptions on some Chinese computer parts. A delegation from El Paso is in Washington, D.C. this week, pushing for more accountability among immigration enforcement officers. KERA's Mallory Falk has more.
The delegation is organized by the immigration advocacy group Border Network for Human Rights. It includes about 40 members, mostly from El Paso and southern New Mexico. The group plans to meet with lawmakers to share testimonials from the border and encourage them to pass the Homeland Security Improvement Act. A key piece of that bill would create an ombudsman position within the Department of Homeland Security to oversee concerns about border and immigration enforcement. A similar bill introduced by El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar already passed in the House. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
The number of severe lung injury cases linked to vaping is growing in Texas. According to the latest figures from state health officials, North and Southeast Texas account for more than 70% of the 189 cases. Juanita Hawkins with Harris County Public Health's Youth Vaping Prevention Program works with middle and high school students.
We usually always have at least one person in the classes that have said that they've tried it before. So I always encourage them that if they do start to feel trouble breathing, if they have cough or chest pain, nausea, anything like that, like if they start to not feel well, to definitely seek out medical attention.
In Texas, minors account for a quarter of the severe lung disease cases. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University. Focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Water insecurity is a challenge that's prevalent in every state in the richest country in the world. That is according to a new report by the U.S. Water Alliance and Dig Deep. This is a policy and research nonprofit based in the nation's capital. The report is called Closing the Water Access Gap in the United States. Nora Nelson is one of the authors, and she's also a hydrologist who leads the research in Texas, Appalachia, and the Four Corners Navajo Nation. Nora, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
I suppose a lot of listeners may wonder how it is possible that in 2019, in the richest country in the world, we're having a conversation about water security no matter where you are, water insecurity, I should say. How is that possible?
You know, that's a great question. And you're right. People out there listening in, they probably would assume that in a country like the United States, that a basic human right, like having access to clean, reliable drinking water would be something that everyone has. But the reality is, in addition to what we found in the hotspots, you know, the United States now has over $1 trillion in backlogged infrastructure upgrades and just needed improvements and repairs to water systems all over the country, urban areas, peri-urban areas, rural areas. So this is a problem that while it's impacting our hotspots, if we don't start doing something to address it now, it's going to start growing in a way that we don't want to see.
When you say hotspots, I mean, I think about, for instance, here in Texas, there are the Colonias, for example, and
right.
Those may be considered a hotspot. But some of this infrastructure that you describe seems to go all the way to the back to the times of the founding fathers, right?
Yes, there have been instances in the not too recent past where out east in the eastern part of the U.S. they've dug up wooden water mains that have been there since time immemorial.
Wooden water mains—that's incredible.
Yeah, it is very incredible. But you know, all over the country, we're seeing in Appalachia, we're seeing outdated coal camp systems that might be lead pipes. Obviously, Flint is on everyone's mind. So people all over the country are dealing with just outdated infrastructure that's really just putting public health at risk.
Let's talk about some of these other terms that are used in this report, donut holes. Could you tell us what a donut hole is?
Sure. So what we see in the Colonias, there are about 2,300 Colonias in Texas, and only 7% of those are considered large, having about 1,000 residents or 300 homes, so like a large subdivision. So the Colonias that have been left are small. They're often trapped by other suburban sprawl in particular. In the case of El Paso County, for example, you might find a Colonia where they're in the middle of other development. Those developments all have paved roads. They have running water, electricity. And these Colonias might be in line of sight of existing water lines, of electrical lines, of those paved roads. But for whatever reason, the county doesn't necessarily want to take responsibility. And so the buck is just sort of getting passed around, and no one wants to deliver these basic services to these communities.
Underscored in this report is that the biggest predictor of water insecure communities is race. How so?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we found that if you're Black or Latino, you're twice as likely to be living without reliable access to clean water. But if you're Indigenous, Native American, you are 19 times as likely to be living without clean water. And a lot of that does have to do with historical inequities, people not being brought to the table as part of the process for negotiating water rights or just negotiating for the basic needs for their communities. In the Colonias, for example, people purchase their land through a predatory process called contract for deed. And so unlike a traditional mortgage where you're paying your mortgage every month and you're building equity in your property and in your home, mm-hmm. people that were engaged in a contract for deed process, they were not building any equity and they didn't own their land until every last cent was paid off. And they were often told, oh, you'll get electricity here, water will come here, paved roads will come here. But some of these Colonias have existed for 40 years and that's just never materialized.
I understand, of course, that there's a kind of bright spot among some of these colonias. How so?
You know, the colonias are actually, it's weird to frame it this way, but they are fortunate. Texas does actually have a really good network of publicly accessible water kiosks. They're not an ideal solution. People are still paying, you know, significantly more per volume than they would if they were just getting the municipal rate for the water coming out of their tap. Unlike our other hotspots, you know, the water is safe to drink. It's reliable. It's there 24 hours a day, and it is a solution. So that's something that we do like to see. And we've seen some similar examples of community-managed kiosks in some of our other hotspots like Appalachia. But, you know, even solutions like that are very few and far between. And it just seems like something so easy.
Well, then let's cut to recommendations. What could be done to increase water security?
So I think one of the best solutions, something that we've looked at that's maybe a little atypical and which is kind of the bread and butter of what Dig Deep does, is really looking at decentralized solutions to kind of close the gap, especially in talking to counties or municipalities. The cost of line extension is just prohibitive. And we've seen that, you know, in all of our hotspots have that issue, the Navajo Nation, Appalachia. And there are, of course, various challenges related to that. Anything you can do, write an op-ed, go to your local water board meeting, link up with organizations like Dig Deep to find out, you know, what options are for helping in your community, or even just look for those great local community partners, link up with them and see how you can support them in their various endeavors.
Nora Nelson is a hydrologist and one of the research directors of Closing the Water Access Gap in the United States. Nora, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Anytime. Happy to do it. Thank you.
Did you ever sit straight up in bed with something circling around your head and you swat at it as it whizzes by and it's just one pesky little fly? You shake your head and twitch your nose and settle down to sweet repose. And when you're just about to doze, fly trouble.
My name is Wizzy Brown and I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and I work with insects. So with antlions, it's also called a doodle bug. Most people that I talk to have no idea what the adults look like because that's not typically what they see. Most people, when they're dealing with antlions, they are seeing the little antlion pits that are going to be in soil or sandy protected areas. The adults are actually very pretty and they're very cool and are often mistaken for damselflies, but they can be usually grays or browns, and they usually, the adults are gonna be flying around in kind of areas with trees that are more forested or things like that, which might be why people don't see them as often. But as far as the immatures, they are really cool. So you're gonna have this kind of little globular body. And then they have their head that has these huge sickle-shaped mandibles. They will kind of back down into the soil. And as they're doing that, they'll start spinning around in a circle. So kind of a backwards circular pattern. And they're taking their head and kind of using it as a shovel. And so they'll dig it under the dirt and flip that dirt up. And so as they're doing that, they're making that kind of cone-shaped spiral pit that then once they fully bury themselves, only their mouth parts are really sticking out of it. And they will have their mouth parts wide open. So as insects, ground-dwelling insects, are walking across the land looking for food or mates or whatever they're doing, they will, you know, fall into this pit. And, you know, if you fall into a pit, you're going to try to climb out of the pit. So the antlion will start kicking that dirt or sand up the walls of the pit, which is causing this avalanche effect to occur, and it's driving whatever fell into the pit down to the mouth parts of the antlion. And once it's in reach, the antlion snaps its jaws shut so it can eat on whatever it has caught, which, you know, a lot of times is ants because, you know, hey, it's an antlion and, you know, ants walk around on the ground, so it totally makes sense. The other interesting fact that me and my geeky self like is the Pit of Carkoon in Star Wars on Tatooine, outside of Jabba the Hutt's palace. The Sarlacc pit is very similar to an antlion pit. So if you think about the Sarlacc pit, which, go watch Return of the Jedi, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's this giant pit in the desert, so you've got the sandy environment, and then when they look down in that, you've got these big jaws kind of coming up out to eat whatever's thrown to it. And in this case, it was Boba Fett and not an ant, but, you know, you got to go with what you want. Did George Lucas possibly know a little bit about antlion biology when he was creating Star Wars, or did he just kind of come up with something randomly that was very similar to the way that antlion immatures are? I don't know, but it's interesting. I'm Wizzy Brown for the Texas Standard.
Wizzy Brown is a program specialist with the Texas A&M AgriLife Service. She's also our go-to insect expert. You got something bugging you? Send us a line, find us on social media, or shoot us an email, texasstandard@kut.org. Texas is trying to fix serious problems with special education. Consider this. In just the past few years, the number of students who need to be tested to see if they should receive special ed services has soared by 50%. But Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee found another issue. There often aren't enough evaluators to do that testing.
Southwest of Houston and Fort Bend County, this workforce shortage worries Jennifer Byrne.
It's a ton of pressure.
She's the district's assistant director for special ed.
I'm constantly thinking about it at night in the shower. What else can I do? What can I try differently? And every year we've tried something different.
Things they've tried: a $5,000 signing bonus, a retention bonus, shifting some duties to counselors to lighten the workload. Still, Fort Bend has 9 school psychologist vacancies, almost 20% of the department's staff. That's why Byrne says they're growing their own with an internship program.
What's your takeaway? What do you feel you have a stronger understanding of that you can walk away with today?
I guess this chart, it's making more sense on what each bubble means and how they interact with each other.
Graduate student Shamika Davis and 6 others are a part of it. Next year, Davis hopes to work in Fort Bend ISD as a school psychologist.
Looking 9 months into the future, I'm excited just to see what an actual caseload looks like. Like, not just waiting on my supervisor. It's like, no, you're in it. This is what you're doing. How are you going to manage that?
That's a good question. Fort Bend isn't the only district looking to fill these positions. Statewide, there's only 1 licensed school psychologist for every 2,800 students. National guidelines say there should be at least 4.
Coming in, it can be overwhelming. Just hearing those numbers is like, oh my gosh, this is a lot of work.
The shortage leaves current school psychologists with huge caseloads. Stephanie Barbary is the incoming president of the Texas Association of School Psychologists. She says it's the worst in East Texas, where 31 districts don't have any school psychologists on staff.
And even looking at the data across the 20 regions in Texas, not one of them met the recommended ratio. The only ones that got somewhat close were in the Austin and San Antonio areas.
Barbary says burnout contributes to the shortage. State rules say special ed testing has to be done in a certain time frame.
But at the same time, if you have, you know, evaluations stacked up, we only get a certain amount of hours in the day. And unfortunately, something's got to give. So do you sacrifice the quality or do you sacrifice the quantity?
State administrators say they're trying to ease the shortage by recruiting more in colleges and maybe making the certification process more flexible. But some advocates say the Texas Education Agency isn't doing enough. Stephen Aleman with Disability Rights Texas say they've suggested ideas, but not seen much action. And Aleman says the need is urgent. He predicts at this pace, children with disabilities will wait even longer for the help they need.
If we're having struggle still at sort of step one, step two, step three of providing the appropriate programming and seeing the improved results are just that much further down the road.
In Fort Bend, intern Shamika Davis sees at least one silver lining to the workforce shortage.
It makes me feel good that, hey, I'm getting in, helping where it's needed. So it does make me, you know, feel good about what I'm doing and where I am.
And she'll have job security. Even if the district hires her entire intern class, they'd still have open positions. In Houston, I'm Laura Eisensee for the Texas Standard.
Laura's coverage of the situation with special ed in Texas continues tomorrow. You won't want to miss that report. You also want to stick around, well, unless you're of a certain age. You see, I understand we're going to be talking about sex ed in the city of Austin. And some of what we'll be talking about is not necessarily approved for younger ears, if you know what I'm saying there, parents. So it's interesting nonetheless. You'll definitely want to hear it if you are of age. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Times. A whole lot more of the Standard just ahead, so stick around. Got tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A former Fox News host and conservative blogger says the Austin Independent School District voted to mandate a pornographic sex education policy that includes instruction on what and how to place a what on a what. Maybe we should give a little heads up to parents that what we're about to talk about appears to be about some sensitive issues relating to, Madeline Meckleberg knows all about these matters. Facts, that is. She's a fact checker from PolitiFact, Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Good to see you, Madeline.
Good to see you, too.
This is a little awkward fact check, I think it's probably safe to say, because
a little
this
bit
has to do with a claim being made about a new policy on sex education.
That's right.
And the Austin Independent School District. Tell us a little bit about who actually made this claim and what this person says about this new policy.
Okay, so as you said, this is a conservative blogger. His name is Todd Starnes.
I've heard his name, yeah.
Yes, you might be familiar with him. He wrote a blog post on his website talking about this new curriculum that was adopted at the end of last month in the Austin Independent School District. And he was talking about some of the concerns that certain conservative organizations have about the policy. And he had this really crazy headline that said that the Austin School Board was mandating the instruction of anal sex in its classrooms.
All right.
And he went on to say that in spite of overwhelming opposition from parents and pastors, the district's trustees voted early Tuesday morning to implement a pornographic sex education policy that includes instruction on anal sex and how to place a condom on an erect penis.
All right. Well, there's a lot to unpack there.
let's
begin with the pornographic part of this. I can see why some people would be concerned if there was something here. Is the policy pornographic, and how does one describe pornography, or even define it for that matter? I think I might know what it is if I saw it, as one Supreme Court justice once said.
That's right. So all of the materials related to this new curriculum are available online for parents and people in the community to review. It includes what the teacher talks about, and it also includes handouts that are given to students, so I could see exactly what he was talking about. Instruction materials that were produced for third through fifth graders include anatomical drawings that depict internal anatomy of both male and female reproductive systems.
Sounds like standard stuff that you see in sex ed course.
That's right. And then materials for sixth through eighth grade do include drawings of internal and external anatomy for both reproductive systems. But
All right.
again, that's kind of traditional to what you'd expect to see in a sex education classroom. When we look at what pornography actually is, there are a lot of different ways we can interpret it, both legally and just culture.
Right.
But Merriam-Webster say that pornography is the depiction of erotic behavior, as in pictures or writing, intended to cause sexual excitement. So I think that intention part is really important here. It's commonly accepted that these kinds of medical materials are not considered pornography. And most important is that Texas law prohibits the distribution or display of, quote, harmful materials to minors, which includes pornography. So if there was pornography, it would be illegal for them to be showing it.
All right. So there are also some claims in here that specific sex acts are depicted. Is that true?
So the sex act that he's talking about is mentioned on a list of commonly recognized types of sexual activity, and it's also included on a list of possible vehicles for transmitting sexually transmitted diseases, but there's no detailed descriptions of it. There's no specific instructions about it.
Any illustrations of it or anything like
that? No illustrations, nothing like that.
Okay, so, but it is mentioned.
It is mentioned.
Okay, what about the use of the condom?
So this is included in the curriculum. Austin is actually one of the few school districts in Texas that has an abstinence plus education policy.
Which means what?
That means that their sex ed courses encourage abstinence, but also discuss other methods of preventing pregnancy and diseases. And that doesn't come into play until the middle school curriculum. And that's when we see these other types of contraceptives be discussed. Seventh and eighth grade curriculum do include information about how to use a male condom, which includes drawings and descriptive texts with instructions.
Okay. So what is the ruling on Todd Starnes' claim about the pornography, as he alleges, in the Austin Independent School District's new curriculum on sex ed?
We rated this claim mostly false. The only thing he got right was the use of condoms being taught in the instruction materials.
Mostly false, this claim by Todd Starnes, the former Fox News radio host, who said in a blog post that the new sex education curriculum adopted by the Austin Independent School District is pornographic. It includes specific sex acts and such. We'll direct you over to the folks at PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. For more details, Madeline Meckelberg heads things up over at PolitiFact Texas. Madeline, good to see you again, and we'll see you again next week.
Looking forward to it.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar is back with us to tell us what Texans are talking about on social media.
Yeah, imagine that.
Imagine that.
Mentioned this one earlier. President Donald Trump with a planned visit to Austin Wednesday, accompanied by Apple CEO Tim Cook on a tour of company facilities in Central Texas. And he's not coming alone. Word is Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow, daughter Ivanka Trump, and son-in-law Jared Kushner expected to accompany the president there. Interesting reactions we're seeing here on Facebook. Buddy Nooning, he writes, he points this out. You know, there's been a lot of hay made over the fact that Apple is producing one of its top-of-the-line computers here in Central Texas at this facility. But Buddy Nooning on Facebook notes that it's not a new plant. It's a subcontractor plant that's been there for years already. And David Scrogan, he notes that it's a flex contractor who's only producing this one item that accounts for just a small percentage of Apple sales. The big issue that people on the ground in Austin are noting is vocalized here by Amelia Edwards. She asks, when I've got to plan my danged commutes. And as any Austinite or any big city resident knows, it's those presidential visits and those motorcades can make getting across town a little difficult.
This is the second presidential visit to some kind of a factory or facility here in Texas in as many months. There's been a lot of talk on places like The Hill, the newspaper that covers Capitol Hill and that sort of thing, that Texas may be more of a battleground state for Donald Trump than perhaps some have assumed.
Yeah.
That's in part because of the changing, you know, demographics
exactly.
of Texas.
Exactly. Yeah, and we've seen that play out with, like, you know, state politics, and I think of the controversy surrounding the House Speaker Dennis Bonin and that secret recording where he's talking about how Trump is really damaging Republican prospects in the suburbs. So
obviously he wants to come to Texas, see what he can do.
Keeping a grip on it, for sure. Well, you know, this is a development to a story that we've carried, that we've talked about for quite some time. The fallout from this botched Houston drug raid that killed two people, wounded four officers, taking yet another step forward. This was back in January of the year. There's this tip alleging large amounts of drugs, weapons in this Houston home. It led to a no-knock raid, gunfire, those deaths and injuries, but little of what had been mentioned in the tip recovered. Well, now the FBI has made a move, and FBI Houston tweeted this morning, breaking: FBI arrested on federal charges this morning Gerald Goines, Stephen Bryant, both former Houston police officers, the two officers at the center of that incident, and the 911 caller in connection with the January fatal Harding Street narcotics operation. So we knew that authorities were going back and looking at previous cases that these officers had been involved in. Now the FBI taking this next step. So obviously a story that we'll be continuing to follow, and a lot more developments will be coming out of that one.
Apparently the indictments are for federal civil rights
charges. These pretty serious charges here. Two counts of first degree murder. It's a story we'll continue to keep track of here on the Texas Standard, among others. We'd love to hear from you. Keep us informed of what's going on in your neck of Texas at Texas Standard on social media. We'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you can join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.